how should we handle the technology? And this is a really big question. That's okay. The technologies that are coming out in order to make the person who is currently the least well off better off, because they're not going to have access to that right away.
You need to legislate it. You need to make sure it gets into their hands.
They're not going to know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Don't. First of all, you don't get to decide what someone does with something you put in their hands. All you can do is give them tools and see what happens.
Can we even talk about legislating access to technology, though, if not everybody has access to healthcare?
Absolutely.
This is not an either-or thing. I would love. I mean, honestly, let's face it.
There's lots of legislation we've tried to pass around access to technology. I mean, the fact that people in the third world don't have access to medications because people feel like they own the idea of a medication.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
Especially when they go to the place
that they can't get
and
an
take
operating
their native
system that they can edit because someone owns the operating system that's available to them. That's fucked up. We saw a great lecture by Evan Moglen, who runs a free software foundation, the other day. He basically said there are tons of Einsteins out there who are wasting away because they're not allowed to learn physics. And every time you use free software, you're helping another one of them to learn physics, and you're bringing more Einsteins into the world. So access to justice is a huge issue. It's something we can't legislate.
I think access to technology costs less over time, where access to medicine may unfortunately cost more over time. So
I think
it might be easier to provide basic access to technology than basic access to medicine.
What? Just a real quick thing to that. Why isn't medicine a technology?
Medicine is definitely a type of technology.
Well,
a lot of technology is non-rivalrous, where a lot of medicine is rivalrous. The economic playing field.
You mean like Microsoft?
Software versus physical medicines. The idea that if I take a drug, someone else can't take that exact same drug because I physically took it, but with a piece of software, I can use that and that person over there can use it. The non-rivalrous nature of software allows it to be distributed on a larger scale for less cost.
Okay, if that's the case, I think we're using technology metonymously to say software.
Right, things that can be converted to bits.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking in terms of, and I think that's absolutely necessary, and I think it's really, really important that people have access to that, because once they have the capability to have, if you have internet service in rural villages in Africa, you can have the transmission of information that allows people to have better systems of knowledge sharing so that they can provide in their communities for healthcare. But I was thinking more about the impetus than the capability. Like, if we're not interested as a society, if we don't think it's important that people have a basic standard of living, how can we look at equal access to information as important? That's kind of...
Because information is intimately tied with your quality of living.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is it seems like there isn't a lot of general concern about people's quality of living.
I understand, I totally agree. There really is not, at least not in this country, there's really not a whole lot of general concern about people's quality of living. In our nice culture that, like, in the bubble that is Seattle, there's tons. Go down to the Midwest. You're middle class. Poor people are scum.
Wait,
if you're poor, the people poorer than you are scum. And it's starting to happen. There's sort of a slow groundswell of people going, hold on a minute. Things are pretty screwed up here. Maybe we shouldn't be living in this kind of way. But it's so diffuse that there's no lobby group for poor people. There is no, I mean, of course, that kind of defines the problem with our democracy right there.
Well, there are lobby groups for the poor, but they don't get listened to
right.
as much as other
people. If you don't have a whole lot of money, you don't get a lobby effectively.
Just one thing about medicine, right, quickly, and then let's get back to the conversation thread. The one thing that's really unique about medicine is that essentially the cost of failure is much higher than in many other endeavors, right? So, like, if you, like, mess up your heart transplant, that's kind of it. Whereas you just reboot your computer and it's, like, no big deal. And so testing is extremely expensive. For new drugs.
Only like a tenth of a percent
But I mean, so I mean, just keep that in mind when you talk about medicine versus other forms of technology, which don't necessarily have those same limitations.
But even within that, though, I mean, there are levels of medicine. I mean, we're talking about pharmacology. That's just one aspect of medicine. Right?
It goes through the whole thing, right? Like, you have to sterilize everything that deals with any sort of operation.
Right.
You have to...
But going back to the idea of information being free, there are a lot of people that diagnose themselves now through, like, WebMD or something like that. And are finding alternative means of treating them themselves. And also, though, that's still, I think, talking about getting us up to, like, medicine is still mostly dealing with getting us up to par and not taking us above that. There are exceptions, but for the most part, I would think that medicine is, you know, medicine's trying to keep people from dying more than it's trying to make people live forever, if that makes sense.
Well, there is, what's his face? The guy with the humongous beard.
Aubrey DeRay.
There you go. Who's all about making people live forever.
Well, I'm sure there's exceptions, but
yeah.
But I think,
I think in
the context of transhumanism, we're more concerned with the sciences that just make us better, not just bring us up to some kind of artificial baseline.
Very fair.
Let's say we can't totally eliminate medicines from that, because many of the medicines that get used or abused to make us better are ones that were originally developed to make us well when we weren't.
Provigil. Have you heard of Provigil?
Oh yeah, the you only have to sleep every other day.
Yeah.
The drug, basically.
Every other day, every 3 days.
It works really well. It's really cool. It's just, just like you had a... I'm serious.
I just wish I had your hands on.
Willow, you got a wonderful sense of timing.
Just Willow, the way you said that, you were like, it works really well.
No, you don't get tweaky, or I'm just tweaky by nature. But it's just like you feel like you actually had a full night of sleep, but you didn't have to sleep.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
See, I just don't sleep. It doesn't work out there at all.
I
enjoy sleeping too much.
I think my dreams would come to get me at some point.
Get back over.
I think I'd have a forbidden planet moment. Yeah.
Wandering around downtown.
What about some of the people who haven't been talking very much, like Rob or?
Well, I wanted to comment on something Willow said. You mentioned that when asked, 95% of people would refuse an advantage that wasn't available to others. But I wondered in practice, how many people would refuse, like, a financial windfall or an inheritance from a relative?
But if you think about how people spread that out, and that a lot of people actually spend that money not just on themselves, but on the people around them. So the people who have families that come across windfalls, they aren't just like, I'm going on a cruise, you bitches are staying here. You know, they take people with them and they increase the quality of life for
for the group,
and
just increasingly smaller.
They use the
family
charities.
Are they thinking about that stuff? I mean, is somebody thinking about that when, like, that happens indirectly, but is that a part of their decision making process?
I don't know.
In a lot of cases,
you
listen to interviews from people who've won the lottery and so forth, and in many cases, you hear people say, well, I'm going to do a couple of things here for myself because I've been wanting to do this for a long time, but then I'm going to take the vast majority of this and donate to charity. I'm going to give it out to my family. I'm gonna,
Or they're doing a lot of coke.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Stimulating the economy.
Yeah.
Just
Bolivia.
Just about the lottery. It's kind of interesting. Actually, a lot of people who win the lottery end up worse off than before because
they don't have food.
Yeah. Well, essentially, they give too much to other people, right? Like, people come knocking on their door and then they end up bankrupt 4 years later.
I went to high school with a guy whose parents won the lottery like 2 years before. His mom still cut his hair in the kitchen. He went to Game Boy, so they went to a pawn shop. But they bought 3 cars, crashed 2 of them, bought 3 more, went on a cruise, and then had to take out title loans to pay the bills at the end of that year before the next lottery check came in because they were just so bad money.
Yeah.
there's crazy.
You receive an insurge of funds that you have no previous experience with, and you don't know how to manage.
There's a really high suicide rate amongst people who have won the lottery or in casinos and stuff, because you're suddenly outside of what your norm is, and you don't know how to behave.
So just to tie that back to what Rob was saying, money is not always sort of a beneficial thing, unlike perhaps some of these modifications potentially could be.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
For me, the discussion on ethics seems to be mainly about the middle class and the scoring relative to the middle class. I feel like I'm poor. I feel like most of us are poor. I feel that we're poor in spirit. My favorite times when you talk are when you talk about, oh yes, and this technology has the possibility of helping these poor people. And your face lights up, and there's the force of dream has overcome you. And that to me is wealth. And the discussion about ethics is hard for me to internalize. It's about how can we meet this homeostatic system.
Yeah. Well, that comes back to what I can't remember the name of this one. John. Either way. What he said earlier, it's not so much what you're doing, but what you do to other people with what you have. It comes back to that being very relevant.
And on that note, if I may, Heinz von Forster, one of his ethical principles was A is better off if B is better off. So, given a relationship between A and B. And I wonder, we started out talking about game theory. And we've talked a lot about competition. And I wonder what else we might talk about. If we considered advancements from the perspective of A is better off if B is better off. If I consider my advancements or advancements within the community in terms of it can make you better, and in return that will eventually reflect back on me. But so I wonder if we can consider this from a perspective of cooperative behavior rather than competitive behavior. And how that would change how we look at modification in general.
I would just like to point out the grand high poobah of competitive game theory being Nash was crazy as a shithouse rat. And that it didn't work most of the time. It worked in very specific circumstances. It works when you have large groups of people making big decisions based solely on their self-interest, but the vast majority of human interactions are based on cooperation. The vast, vast, vast majority. Everything down to deciding who gets right of way at a stop sign is cooperation. We don't play a miniature game theory in our head and this son of a bitch goes, I swear, well,
I
some
have
people
that,
do.
Assuming we're not psychopaths.
Assuming we're not psychopaths.
But we have to also consider that there are some people in the population who
right?
are psychopaths
there's,
who will take every advantage
yeah,
they can
sure,
get.
Be
roughly
the population
8%
does,
of the male population are psychopaths. Fuck them. Pardon
Wait.
My French. But they're not important.
I know Gwen doesn't matter. Like she does, she matters. But she doesn't care so much. But
profane,
I
obscene.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just completely
forgot.
You cannot make decisions for the good of a group based on what the worst people are going to do.
Finish your thoughts, please.
Well, because what happens is when you do that, you enter a very fast, slippery slope of restricting behavior until, hey, why not put cameras everywhere? Because, you know.
You need the data.
Right. Well, one third of 1% of the population might, maybe, possibly be thinking about doing something bad. And maybe they are. In fact, I'm going to guarantee it. They probably are. But you can't live in a society like that.
So I wanted to come back to look at ethics and game theory now that we've had a good volume of discussion about both of them. And I just want to kind of float out just a little idea here, which certainly isn't of my own making by any means, but that essentially almost all successful theories or ethical theories are really sort of a primitive form of game theory. Now, if you look at most of these examples, for example, Mike?
John.
Okay, I'm sorry. said your name. John. Okay, so what John just said, right, was that you can't make decisions based on what the worst people in society are going to do. But in fact, you can, right? It's a Nash equilibrium. No matter what people do, the Nash equilibrium is the best strategy.
The question is, do you want to live in that world?
But what does best mean?
By best, yeah,
like
exactly.
When you're saying with the dreams being the wealth, I think that's the main key of everything. I mean, the competition. What are you competing for? More wealth? So that what type of advantage will you have? If you already have a baseline that's easy to get, you can provide food for your family, comfort, and there's no murdering or killing going on, then where does this competition, what advantage does that give to? It seems like it's in such an abstract realm that to think that somebody's going to whine about having their like competitive pressure placed on them because they can't obtain some, what is really not a necessity, but something that is abstract and evolving in its end, like a car. I mean, a car has productive value that, you know, I'm sure, but, I mean, what?
Yeah, Chris was, Chris Sick from Whitechapel, if anyone's on there, was on Skype earlier, and he left because he was getting too ranty and drunk, but he's like, it's great that you guys are talking about this, but I just saw a 12-year-old girl dealing crack on my way home. So I think that relates back to the idea of, like, how are we gonna help? Because when you say, if A is better off, then B is better off, I think that works so long as it actually impacts everyone in the system. Which is looking out for yourself and the people who are around you.
A and B both have to operate with the assumption that A is better off than B.
Yeah. And so I want to hear actual examples, not more tangents about, which have been phenomenal, but what can we actually do? Because we do a lot of talking here, and that's great. I want to know what we can do. I mean, can we go and, I'm not necessarily going to form a field trip right away, but at some point, I mean, do we teach people how to use the computers at the library? How do you start to close that gap?
That's actually a good message, because I was just earlier coming out from an internet cafe, and this guy was like, just walked in and was asking the cashier at the net cafe, I was like, yeah, do you guys teach classes on how to use a computer? You know, it's like, or where can I go? You know, so he doesn't know, I don't know, he's like, somebody's like in his late 30s,
And
so says, I said, you know, maybe go to the library, you can use some computers there, but they said, you know, no one has the time to like teach you, you know, how to use the computer.
Just as a side note, the Seattle Library generally does classes.
Okay. See, now I know. That's why I just figured, you know, point them to a library, but that is maybe a good.
Yeah, but so
it's generally a solution to those problems.
Yeah.
Libraries.
Computers are a good example. I mean, you know, we talk about transhumanism and stuff. I don't personally have the technology to cryogenically suspend any of you if you suddenly die.
Well,
it
takes money. It's not about.
Well,
at least
right, but off. Right, but you know what I'm saying. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that we talk. You know, artificial implants in my head or whatever. You know, that's a ways off. And, you know, we were talking. Well, I'm saying from what Willow's saying. I mean.
Right.
That's a ways off, right? So I'm not saying they're completely unrelated, but
yeah,
I think that the distribution of information technology is a great thing. And I mean, it's something that we could definitely do that would help.
I mean, this computer has died, like completely died, I think 3 times now, twice before me and once now, and it's been revived every single time. It is now safer and cheaper to mine for gold in old computers than it is to actually dig into the side of mountains. In order to help the people who are at the bottom, we need to think about how we're actually using what we have and how we discard what we have. Not to get all preachy on everyone, but I mean, Libby, I want to start doing more than just sitting around and talking. And if people just want to come to the sitting and talking, that's great. I would really love to still have you here. But I mean, if we can go do guns not bombs, that'd be awesome. If we could go do food not bombs or something.
How about swords not guns?
That would be awesome.
No.
Not swords.
Swords is much worse than guns.
I'll get shot over getting
stabbed. I thought you said swords, not guns. I was going to do like a gun exchange program where like I make them a WordPress blog, they turn their gun.
That would be awesome. We could do that.
Blogs for guns.
Yeah. But you can't think about the future with a capital F if you're hungry. You're just trying to get through the day.
To overshare, I have about 2 weeks until I'm living on the street. So I don't have, you can't think about the future when you're under that kind of pressure. You have no future. You have tomorrow. How do you stop that from happening? As a society, how do you do that? I mean, it's great to give people, a computer, and believe me, if I didn't have computer access, that would be it. I would have nothing. Computer access is probably the single redeeming feature that, because I know how to use a computer, will keep me going past, the immediate future. And it's just true. I mean, teaching people how to use a computer is so valuable. It is so important.
Well, and
I
it's
mean,
not like anything else.
It's,
I mean,
not
it's
like
it's qualitatively
exactly.
different because
you can,
it's giving them access.
Right, and
to
it
so
extends
much.
Throughout the future. It's not something like, for
right,
instance,
like in your situation,
right.
You can use a computer to look for jobs. You
right.
can use a computer to, you can Google search, what do I do if I can't get a job in 2 weeks?
Right.
You can,
exactly.
You can figure
now,
out how
and,
to squat. You can figure out how to forage for food.
You can Google for unemployment.
Oh, yeah, for,
But exactly. I mean, that's why it's so easy when faced with really profound problems to look for profound solutions when those are easily outside of our reach. We're not going to cure world hunger. We're not going to cure poverty. All we really have the ability to do is have a bunch of very bright people who have a lot of good technical skills and time to teach other people those skills.
We do not necessarily have time.
Okay. But that's the other side of it. If you're a bright person with lots of technical skills, it turns out people want your time a lot. Because it's very valuable.
Well, institutionally, though, we have some challenges to face when going out there and trying to implement teaching technology in different areas. I've got an Attorney General grant that we've had at Washington State Bar for 5 years now. It's basically to create these kiosks inside FCMAR's health centers to allow people to contest evictions and look up legal health stuff. The structure there, though, is populated by individuals who don't see the value in technology, so they're fighting the $25,000 grant to put these free kiosks in just to test pilot them. So there's a challenge in trying to convince a hierarchy that grew up without technology that providing technology to their constituent basis who's tech illiterate is important. And I think that learning how to communicate with those people and convince them is a very important skill
yes.
that most people lack. Because we all want to say, oh, it's obvious, you should just do it, but that doesn't convince
right, right.
them.
It's not obvious to my mother.
Well,
you
right,
know,
right.
Do you think that would be more helpful than, say, like fieldwork going out and teaching children how to use computers or something, or anybody that might use a computer? I mean, as a group that starts from transhumanist discussions in general and then switching to action, what is the transhumanist flavor of what we discuss come to reflect in what we do. I mean, what new can we provide? If it's purely the practical sense of teaching, then I don't think there's too much difference. But in terms of a perspective to affect those types of people, I think that could be something that is closer to novel, like a novel capability of the types of perspectives that I guess most of us have.
I mean, I think that the perspective that, my understanding of the perspective is, it's not necessarily new to transhumanism, but it's a very humanistic perspective, which is that we can use technology to empower ourselves and make our lives better. And I think that's something that's kind of not made explicit in the dominant culture, and it's not something that's really talked about. It's just like, oh, with my cool iPhone, like I've got these apps, and it's like, it's not, we can use these as tools to empower ourselves and make ourselves more informed citizens.
And I think that's a core of transhumanism.
Right, and I think it is too, but I don't think it's necessarily unique to transhumanism.
No, no.
But I think that's kind of a core principle that could be transmitted, and that, you know, it's not just like, oh, you can look for a job, like, you know how to use a computer, you have more marketable skills, but no, this is something that's really, that puts a lot of, that gives you a lot of agency in a way that things haven't before. And it's like, it can cause, you know,
so I don't know how many other people work downtown. Willow and I both do. Maybe we can do some brown bags for people, or maybe Ignite talks during lunch hour. Say how to empower yourself with technology, a 101 on philosophy of technology, on where we think the future's going.
We can do that. Especially because there are, I mean, you can get a room at the library or something.
Yeah, they're going to be gone all summer.
Well, I'm booked through summer, so when you come back.
You start
in September. So in 2010, we're on.
So, I wonder, would time be better spent just keeping it very, very practical? It is perhaps less important to explain to someone why they need the internet or can use the internet than how to do it.
Well, okay, so have you ever seen Ignite Talks? Ignite Talks are 5 minutes, 20 slides, 15 seconds per slide, and the idea is that you only talk about the thing that you are passionate about for those 5 minutes, that you ignite passion in others. And I think what Lyon was saying about dreams is very effective. I think a lot of us are very passionate people, and that if we did something in that format where each of us picked, like, you want to do stuff that's really practical. Here's 5 minutes on how to use the internet. I want to do philosophy. Here's 5 minutes on philosophy.
Yeah. Unless you give people a reason to want to use it, they're still not going to use it. And while a lot of that is just practicality, it's also you can find some cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this before. When Twitter was introduced to countries with lower standards of living than ours, they found uses for it that were much less frivolous than our own.
Yeah.
Because their needs were, they have greater needs.
Mm-hmm.
Survival was a much more of a daily concern than it is for us.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume that just introducing the access to the technology and allowing the user to come up with whatever use is best for them would tend to produce positive results.
Two quick things. That speak both to practicality, immediate practicality, and to what John was saying about we're not going to end hunger. Or poverty or whatever. I saw the CEO of Google speak one time, and he was talking about why Google is so successful, and he said one of the reasons we're so successful is because we have lofty goals, and so we aim really, really high. And, you know, even if we fall a little short of that, we're still doing pretty good. Maybe, I agree that we should put some resources into doing practical things, but maybe we could also try asking the hard questions, like, how do we actually fight poverty? How do we cure poverty? How do we cure disease?
I agree, but that's...
And then, absolutely, it's huge, but if you never ask that question, you know, then what? Right?
I agree.
Just because it's big doesn't mean you shouldn't think
about it. And maybe in thinking about it, you don't solve the world's hunger, but maybe you solve part of Seattle's hunger.
I totally agree. I think more my point was, don't let the vastness of problems dissuade you from taking local action.
Right. Because that's something that I have a huge problem with. I tend to become very discouraged pretty quickly when I look at sort of the structural things in place that prevent things like this from happening. And this is kind of a tangent, but I saw this movie Crips and Bloods Made in America. It's a screening is coming up at it totally blew my mind, but basically it's about short post notes version, basically how government policy and structural inequality basically created this, like, the longest running war in American history that nobody gives a crap about because they're brown people in their own little area. And to me, it's like those communities, and I've been listening to a lot of gangster rap lately, and it's like to think about the sort of specificity of that community, it seems like it's kind of impenetrable by things like talking about, you can empower yourself with technology, but like there's this whole new culture that's been created there that has been, the entire intent of the community was to make it so that they don't need anything from the dominant culture, and so that all of our concerns, like the concerns of the society, are irrelevant to them because they can't access it and they haven't been able to access it over generations, so they just create their own little world. And what relevant would it have for people like that in the middle of the richest country in the world who can't, or the most richest country in the world, who can't really have, who can't share in the discourse of citizenship in the way that we all can, coming from where we do, and like what relevance can it have to them? And even if it did have relevance, and even if things could be disseminated, it seems like there's this structure, especially in America, it's what I know, it seems, and over the world, globalization, but like, how do we, like, our government is so heinous and evil, and it does the most fucked up shit. Seriously, like, NAFTA, I mean, like, everything, and if you look at the history of African countries and how we've supported all these coups, you know, in favor of dictatorship, and how we don't really believe in democracy, it seems like those structural forces are so huge, and they, you know, we can do things locally, but how do we attack that? I mean, how do we surmount that? I mean, it just seems like...
First of all, there's lots of people that ask the same questions, and they try to find solutions, and I think that's the first thing to realize, is that these questions haven't been asked, and a lot of the problems as well as solutions that you see come from people trying to do something. I think...
Well,
how do you...
And here you have an example of technology, right? If it wasn't for somebody going and making that movie,
right,
you might not
right.
be aware of that
yeah.
issue
yes.
at all.
That's true.
So getting that movie out there, you know, having a medium for telling that story, and you just have to look for an audience. So I want to make a quick comment about sort of this call to action, and maybe kind of sum up some of the things that people have been saying. I want to preface my statements by saying that I don't ever want to discourage people from going out and doing like good things for other people, right? Like, if you want to go out and volunteer, do not let me step in your way. I mean, just go for it. It will always be a good use of your time. And particularly, when you're sitting in a room like this, it's sometimes easy to get the wrong idea about what the real problems are. And when you have like a good amount of face time with problems, right? Like actual people who actually have like the problems, you talk to them and things like that, you oftentimes get a very different picture about how, you know, how problems work, how things work, and what possible solutions can be. And so there's a lot to be said or getting your hands dirty, in effect. But at the same token, there is... Well, I shouldn't say that there's no shortage of volunteers out there. There's certainly an awful lot of volunteers. And getting back to the Google talk, right? If you really want to make a difference, it strikes me that the physical labor of, you know, adding a couple more hands while it's not insignificant, is certainly vastly outweighed by any sort of structural change that you can make. And so I don't want anyone to get the idea that better understanding problems and possibly solutions is sort of a waste of time or is not productive. So
just the last sentence.
I don't want anyone to get the impression that better understanding problems and their solutions is a waste of time or is unproductive.
Oh.
I agree 100%. I think a lot of the problems, and I've worked in a lot of volunteer organizations, they're some of the worst run organizations you will ever encounter in your life. It's like the death of good intentions. If nothing turns people away from volunteering than actually volunteering with, and it's never the people. My brother is a school teacher, and he loves the kids. He teaches in inner city Durham, North Carolina, which has one of the worst crime rates on the eastern seaboard. It is a pit, and he loves it. They call him White Mike. And he's like the only white guy there. He loves it. The kids love him, and he has a great time. But, you know, the structure of the way everything's set up is just so soul-crushing to him that he calls me and says, I don't know if I can do this next year. And then the next year he calls me and says, I don't know if I can do this next year. And presumably he will call me the next year. So
I think part of why those places are run poorly, though, is that people have not had the experience of actually working in them. You have people that have a whole lot of education and have not gone through things, and they're like, this is how this should be organized.
Yeah.
Without it's the same with anything you do. The software I use, it's built for lawyers, not built by lawyers. Sucks to use as a lawyer.
Can I just take the conversation, the lens, can I take it out a little bit and ask...
Yes.
This is a question that I sort of was trying to deal with a couple of weeks ago when I was getting into arguments with my conservative cousin online. Shouldn't have done that. What is an ethical Gini coefficient? What's an ethical distribution of wealth? The Gini coefficient is basically, if one person has all the wealth in a society, it's one. If it's completely evenly distributed, it's zero. In the United States, it's about 45%, which is about the same as in African dictatorships. In Europe, it's around 30%, Japan, 25%.
That's an awesome way to look at it.
And, I know some people are going to be more able than others, and some people will have advantages or will create advantages, but seriously, what's acceptable in society?
I want to say, based on empirical research, the equal distribution of income is the greatest predictor for longevity and for happiness. I mean, however they measure happiness, but if you look at the economists and their measure of happiness, whatever that consists of, access to a lot of basic things and ability to just affect, a lot of things go into it, but basically it's not how much real wealth you have, it's what you have compared to those around you. So I think one of the, Kerala, southern province of India has an incredibly high life expectancy and incredibly happy people, despite the fact that it's extremely poor, because there is much less inequality there than in most places in the world. And then you go somewhere like California, where it's one of the wealthiest states and one of the wealthiest countries in the nation. And people there, people in the ghetto, for the most part, aren't starving. They're not as bad off as people in third world countries who are dying of malaria all over the place and don't have enough food day to day.
They have plenty of access to stuff full of high fructose corn syrup.
Right, right. And it's, people aren't, they're very poor compared to those around them. They're not dying. If they knew how to use their resources and they were in the same boat, they would have presumably much better ability to sort of get by and have an equitable type of lifestyle. Whereas when you have people who have this tremendous inequality, it causes a lot of intense problems.
I wonder if that's because we're competing instead of living communal.
Right.
pretty hardwired.
Yeah, I think so. I was shocked. I went to Copenhagen when I was in high school, and I had been told my whole life, raised in America, that, you know, this poverty problem, we just can't solve it. We can't do it. And you go to Copenhagen, there is no poverty. There are no people on the streets. We did homestays with people there. I stayed in their home, and it was beautiful, and it was huge. And I was like, how did you afford a home like this? You're just, you know, you're plain middle-class people. And they're like, oh, well, everyone has a home. Where would you live if you didn't have a home? And I was just like, 20% in more in taxes can do this? Like,
yeah. Before,
seriously?
Yeah.
Why are we... why are we so fucked up?
Why would you want to hoard your wealth then? I think that's what the question comes down
exactly.
to. I mean,
because you're a psychopath?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yes, but so, so
there you go.
Just one thing said, and please talk after this. If you are receiving money and spending it at a rate sort of that's equal to as you're receiving it, will what types of effects in change, as change is a vague term, will that have, as opposed to if you get a lot and then spend it and then, you know, you hoard some wealth and then spend a large chunk of it on a problem. I mean, these are total, using those two different ways of spending is a completely different way of looking at the issues that you're considering to affect with your wealth.
Well, either way, it goes to a corporation, right? If you're spending it, it goes to corporate profit. If you're hoarding it, presumably you're investing it,
right,
which injects capital into corporations, and so I don't see much of
a difference.
I love
how
there.
All of our meetings go to the apocalypse and or capitalism.
Is
So I just wanted to make a quick sort of comment on what you said about equality. So there's a considerable body of happiness research out there, and I think it's mostly done on surveys, actually, is how they do it. And that up to a certain threshold, wealth and happiness are extremely highly correlated, which should be fairly obvious if you're familiar with... I'm sorry?
In the U.S.?
Yeah, well, yeah. So once essentially you get your bottom rung of Maslow's hierarchy of needs filled, then the correlation becomes much less strong.
In the U.S., it's about $28,000 a year, I think.
Well, but so I think the point, though, is that at least looking internationally, it strikes me that absolute wealth is a much more pressing need than relative wealth, right? So, like, if you can keep...
I don't know if you want to phrase it like that.
Why would the main
Americans
so happy?
Needs are, I don't think you need wealth to provide basic needs.
It's
state to provide housing and food.
Well, so what I mean by wealth is,
care.
Like, stuff that people want, right? Like, basic
okay.
needs.
Okay.
Like, things that people find valuable, like a roof over their head and food and clean water and...
A wigwam fish.
Yeah.
Sure, but I mean...
Kurt, nice.
The answer was
sex work.
I've got to say that not to romanticize third world poverty, because it's not, it sucks, it's really, really, really lame, but when I was in Kenya, with the kids here, you know, they had come from the streets where, you know, you don't eat day to day and you don't have a roof under your head. These kids were so happy to be in a single block dormitory with a tin roof over their head, sleeping three to a tiny bed and getting rice and beans three times a day. And that was like, that was amazing to them. And they were so grateful and they were happy and playful, and they knew that they didn't have as much as people in the West or people who were living, you know, in the nice part of town. But they were happy. And I've known people here who are like, God, I'm so poor, this sucks. Like,
yeah.
I don't have any money, I'm so poor, and just feel really sorry for themselves because
I only eat twice today.
Or no, and even if we're eating, no, even if they have as much food as they could ever want, it's still like, I can't afford to go on vacation. This sucks. And it's just, I think there's like the idea of having your basic needs met is like, there's a balance. You need to have your needs met, but if the guy next to you is having his needs met and also being able to have, you know, go to space for vacation, it's like,
I think a big factor is you also have to see that person who's doing those things is no better a human being than you. Because you don't feel bad if, like, you know, someone puts Stephen Hawking in a giant robot so he can rule the universe at his rightful place. Because you're like, oh, he's Stephen Hawking. He's a great guy. He kind of deserves it. But, you know, if it's just some other schmuck who, you know, every rich guy in the world don't work that hard. They really don't. I've known a lot of them. They don't work that hard. I mean, it's easy. Once you make a certain amount of money, you don't work that hard.
When you know that, then it gets underneath your skin. Because then you start questioning your own worth as a human being. Because everything in society is telling you, look, he's no better. He's you could be him. Why aren't you? Aren't you trying hard enough?
I know from my own experience, every job that I've had has successively been easier and pay better.
Yes.
Sure.
But there is a certain point where you are being paid for the stress level you're at. I think that it depends on which course of employment you've taken, which career path, but I mean,
I hopped from cashier to tech writer, so.
Okay. My sister-in-law has just been entered into a program to be the administrator for a healthcare program for the elderly. And whereas when you enter in, it's pretty low stress, and you don't get paid that much. As you get paid more, you're working for salary, you know, 80-hour weeks, and everyone's screaming at you all the time. So there are...
Responsibilities go up, expectations go up, stress levels go up.
Right. So
I
feel like that's universally true, but there's definitely some truth to it.
Yeah.
I mean, the hardest job I ever had was at a glass factory. I worked at a glass factory for a year. And that was the most back-breaking, soul-destroying labor that I have ever done in my life. Got paid very well for it, but still... I've done office work where I've gotten paid twice as much. So easy. So beautifully easy. It's great. And you gotta compare like getting up in front of like 8,000 degree ovens every day. It just doesn't compare. It's not even in the same world.
And what is easy for work is also entirely relative.
Exactly. Like for me that was
he's saying that working in a grocery store was much harder work than being a tech writer.
Yeah, I'll back that up.
I'll tell you right now, I would find being a tech writer because I'm just not, you know, tuned that way. My life experience is not able to do that.
So let's wrap it up. We're at our, what I like to increment as when I upload the audio. So for that arbitrary value, I'm going to ask us to.
You need an acronym for that.
I will come
it's
up.
It's the wrap it up point.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my god. Approaching button push.
Anyone have any closing
the
points?
The wrap it up time.
Closing points? Anyone?
I think one interesting closing point on at least changing your perspective and reaching out to others. I think the Google example, along with the Ignite Seattle example and kind of Lion's example of kind of seeing the dream in people's face, all have a commonality in it that when somebody is doing something within their bliss, maybe that 20% time that Google gives you or those Ignite talks about something passionate or the things that really make somebody dream, I think that's when you have the opportunity to reach out to others is when you're trying to use that which you really care about and people can see the excitement in yourself and that's what can ignite it in other people. So. And if we want to cause change, which several of us here definitely do, like you need to take that you're passionate about and convey that passion along with some practical tools.
Theo, thank you for meeting.
Oh. By all means, it was a great time.
And if anyone else wants to, I mean, we're lined up for things. John's going to present on etiquette at some point, and you're going to present on rituals sometime, maybe.
Well, wasn't that the same thing? We were talking about etiquette and ritual together, because you had mentioned Libby.
We also
etiquette and ritual together?
No, etiquette.
I think we spun.
These are two different worlds.
I'm gonna say, I'll tell you like ahead of time, I pretty much know that. I don't think there'll be a whole lot of overlap.
So we can two separate ones, and I'm trying to find a new person. The guy I had for nanotech got shipped off to somewhere in California to work on something really fancy. But there's another guy in nanotech that might come in and talk, and hopefully nanorobotics. And I want to, when it gets really hot out, we're going to talk about cryogenics and eat popsicles. I hope everyone is okay with this. And
cryogenic people can eat popsicles?
No, we're going to talk about cryogenics.
We're going to talk about people who are in cryogenics
eating popsicles.
Well, eating popsicles.
I'm eating cryogenic people as popsicles?
Yes.
Okay.
I like the direction this
they're
is going.
Pops.
I want you to take clause A, and we're going
We also just got a forum added on to the Wikipedia, which Charles was nice enough to do for us. So I know not many of you ever go to the Wikipedia, but it's there now. And if you ever want to...
The wiki?
Oh yeah, it's not a Wikipedia, sorry. Have to retract that, otherwise they'll sue me.
There's a wiki for this group?
Yes, there's a wiki for this group.
It's linked off the Facebook.
Yeah, and I will happily write it down also.
I feel you. I have a few forums and wikis.
So, yeah. And I figure it'll probably be for follow-up discussion on things that we've already covered or things that are coming up. That way we can just keep ideas going. If anyone's in for that, that's cool. If not, I'll just yammer it myself like usual.